Aloha, this is Carol Cox. Please join me here on KWAI 1080 AM on Sunday mornings from 8 to 9 AM. We will discuss local and national government issues, environmental issues, and some lighthearted subjects. So please join me on Sunday at 8 AM to 9 AM here on KWAI. Okay, good morning and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. Good to have you back and be back with you. Today that was Wilson Pickett, 99 and a half, just won't do. You can apply that any way you wish, but I'm pretty excited today. You know, we always talk about environmental issues here in Hawaii and around the world and globally and how it's impacting, and I'm fortunate enough to be able to reach out and speak with people in Florida, and so we're going to go across the pond today, so to speak, and speak to Mr. Matthew Schwartz, and we're going to be talking about the Everglades and nuclear power plants, that the expansion and what have you, and hopefully you join in, and 524-1080 is the call-in number if you have any questions or comments, and it's kind of interesting as you look at the paper and the news. You see Fukushima still about us, and many of the misstatements and mistruths being made told by the authorities there in Japan. So I'm excited today, and hopefully you learn something and share with you what's going on in the Everglades. So good morning, Matthew. How are you?
I'm fine, Carol. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and thank you for calling in.
Can I ask you, I'm having a little bit difficulty hearing you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. I hear you great.
Okay, the volume's a little low on the listening side, but as long as you can hear me, I can,
okay.
We can continue.
How about now? You should be good now.
It's a little, I can hear it. I can hear it.
Okay, all righty. Okay, well, I'm pretty sure we'll be able to pick you up there. It should be better now.
Okay.
little turn of the dials and the knobs and the tubes. So, anyway.
Unfortunately, I have no knobs on this end to turn to make it louder. I've tried.
Yeah. But tell us a little bit about yourself, your organization, and you had a rally this weekend, just yesterday. And if you could share some of the insight there, and then we'll get all the good things about the Everglades and all.
Okay. Well, first of all, like I said, thanks for having me on the show. I've been to Hawaii one time back in the 80s, and I had a friend that was living on the Big Island at the time, mm-hmm. and I spent about 2 weeks there. And we'll never forget it. And we'll never forget my visit to Hawaii and the Big Island. I was there when it was, I think, New Year's Day, and we were watching the news from his home at night and found out that the big volcano was going off.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in his truck and drove to, I guess it's called Volcano National Monument, and walked out to a lava dome where we could actually see the volcano erupting, and it was just unforgettable. Mm-hmm. Unforgettable to be watching land being created in that way. But you wanted an introduction, so my name is Matthew Schwartz. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and moved down to South Florida in the mid-90s, and currently, well, I've been active in the Sierra Club as a volunteer and officer. I lead outings to places like the Big Cypress National Preserve and Everglades National Park and a lot of the natural areas in South Florida. About a year ago, myself and about four friends, we founded the South Florida Wildlands Association, and South Florida Wildlands is dedicated to protecting the natural areas, habitat, species, plants in South Florida, and I am the executive director of that mm-hmm. organization.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday, we decided we were going to have a large rally, an anti-nuclear rally in general, but specifically to protest the expansion of a local nuclear power plant called the Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant.
Mm-hmm.
And that is owned by a utility called Florida Power and Light. Currently, the utility has two nuclear generators there of about 600 megawatts each. And they are in the process of applying for the construction of two more of over 1,100 megawatts each. So they're looking to expand that nuclear power plant tremendously at a time when world attention is obviously focused on the dangers of nuclear power. I mean, we'll talk about what's going on in Fukushima a little bit. And what happened in Chernobyl 25 years ago. It was April 26, 1985, when the Chernobyl disaster occurred. And people know that there's a no man's land, a no woman's land, a no, you know, just basically a no entry land around the Chernobyl plant. But until you actually look at the map, the action alert you saw that I sent out to you actually had a link to the area around Chernobyl, which is no longer habitable.
Mm-hmm.
And that area is about the size of the state of New Jersey. It's big. A crazy new form of adventure tourism has sprung up where people can actually take tours, and they'll allow you in for a little while, and you could tour the abandoned city of Pripyat, which is the city largest city closest to the Chernobyl plant. And it's not an abandoned town. It's a city with high-rises and schools and universities and hospitals, except it's completely deserted, but everything is there.
Mm-hmm.
So people are kind of touring that area right now. So the demonstration yesterday had two main parts to it. The first part was we did a mock kayak rescue. So we launched boats, kayaks, off the shores of a local park called Homestead Bayfront County Park, which overlooks the nuclear power plant. It's about a mile and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to imagine what it would be like to have to rescue people from South Florida. There are 3.5 million people in the greater Miami area who live within 50 miles of Turkey Point. Now, folks following the Fukushima disaster know that the U.S. government has strongly advised, I'm not sure if they have the power to order, but they have strongly advised U.S. nationals living within 50 miles or 80 kilometers of the Fukushima plant to evacuate.
Mm-hmm.
And Australia and British UK has done the same with their nationals. So if we were to take that same advisory and put it in South Florida and put ground zero at Turkey Point, roughly 3.5 million people would have to abandon the area. and where 3.5 million people of South Florida would go is another question. So we did a kind of mock evacuation. We had kayaks and canoes off the shore in between the park and the plant. There was a lot of video taken and still photos taken of the shot. Then we followed it up with a rally where we had about 8 speakers from different environmental organizations here in South Florida, including elected officials. We had a local mayor from the city of South Miami, a city commissioner from the city of Lake Worth, all talking about various aspects of building a new nuclear plant and the consequences. Obviously, the safety issue was number one, but we also talked about the ecological impacts, and we talked about the economic consequences of what it means when a utility like FPL, Florida Power and Light, decides they want to invest. I think the current figure, and it's always changing, but the current estimate for the cost of the new reactors is somewhere in the neighborhood of $24 billion. Now, that's a huge, huge investment. And who makes that investment, and what could be done with that money instead of 2 nuclear power plants? And, of course, it is ultimately, whether it's in the form of money that FPL is spending, and of course that comes from the people who pay their electric bills to them, or government subsidies, it's ultimately the people's money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are decisions that we think that people should be able to participate in.
Now, let me ask
you. And then we followed it up with a potluck and some music and enjoyed the day out in the park, and finally it rained and poured and everybody went home.
A good Florida rain. But let me ask you,
what about the waste that
is generated by the existing plant, and are they able to dispose of it, and where are they disposing of it, or where are they storing it?
That's a very good question, Carol. As people might know, there was at one point the plan to build this gigantic waste depository in Nevada, not too far from Las Vegas, called Yucca Mountain. And once that was looked at a little bit closer, they said, well, you know what? It's probably not stable enough to store nuclear waste for the thousands and thousands of years that it needs to be stored before it is no longer a danger. There are problems both with possible earthquakes over that long of a period of time, and exactly what do you put, what container do you put nuclear waste in that's going to last for longer than the lifetime of the Great Pyramids?
Mm-hmm.
What material can last that won't corrode and allow that to escape into the air, into the ground, into the water supplies? The active uranium isotope that creates nuclear power, U-235, a lot of people are not aware how a nuclear power plant works, and you kind of have to understand a little bit of the structure of the atom, the structure of the nucleus of the atom, to get it. Most uranium is pretty stable. While it is somewhat radioactive, it doesn't have nearly enough instability. It doesn't fission, crack, split often enough to create a sustained chain reaction that'll produce nuclear energy. So it's the U-235 isotope is what they're going for. And that stuff is just unstable.
Mm-hmm.
And it splits, and it releases neutrons, it releases gamma rays. And all you need to produce nuclear energy, or a nuclear bomb for that matter, is just put enough U-235 together in the right concentration, and it goes off. So it's inherently producing energy. It's just producing energy. It's not something you could turn on and off with a switch. Turkey Point Nuclear Power Plant, 2 million pounds of waste have accumulated since the 1970s, when that power plant was built. And those 2 million pounds of waste are essentially sitting in concrete swimming pools. They're getting more and more filled every year. Every year they're adding 40 tons of new nuclear waste to those tanks.
Mm-hmm.
With the waste in it. Those tanks sit on the eastern shore of Biscayne Bay. The entire nuclear power plant is surrounded by Biscayne National Park. And I should probably talk a little bit about that bay. I mean, Biscayne Bay is part of the original Everglades ecosystem. The Everglades, I'm not sure how many people in Hawaii have ever been there.
Mm-hmm.
But probably quite a few might have visited. You know, usually when people visit South Florida, they think of South Florida beaches and nightlife and our vibrant cultural mix that we have here, but the Everglades is what kept me in South Florida. The Everglades is an amazing place. It's a gentle, sloping, flat piece of land. I mean, people in Hawaii would kind of recognize the weather here, but they wouldn't recognize the landscape at all. It's flat. And between Lake Okeechobee and Florida Bay and Biscayne Bay, it's just this gentle plain, and the water just kind of gradually gets down here. But I'm kind of diverging. The nuclear waste, it's there. It's piling up every year. There's no way to put it. It's toxic. If it doesn't have a constant flow of fresh water going into it, it will burn. Mm-hmm. The coating around the nuclear fuel rods will catch fire. The nuclear fuel will basically start to melt down. And a lot of the problems that are happening in Fukushima are not the reactor itself. It's actually the nuclear fuel rod waste that was not kept in water because the pumps failed, because when the tsunami came in, it wiped out the pumps that would normally supply fresh water to the pools that keep the waste. The pump shut down, the electricity wasn't there, and that's where a lot of those fires came from.
So,
we're well aware of the nuclear waste problem here.
So you have the potential for hurricanes. You have the potential for tsunamis in Biscayne Bay?
Well, I'm kind of starting to lose you, Carol, but I heard the question. You're still able to hear me, correct?
I'm here. Just keep talking. I can
you hear me fine. Okay.
No problem in this.
Yeah, obviously, South Florida is right in the middle of the hurricane zone, and we do get hurricanes on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
A major hurricane, one of the strongest that hit South Florida, was Hurricane Andrew back in 1993, and that hurricane did hit the Turkey Point nuclear plant. As I said, it was constructed in the 70s. And a lot of the talk about that plant was, well, Turkey Point was hit by Hurricane Andrew and nothing happened, and therefore we proved that we can withstand the hurricane. Well, that's not the complete story of what happened when Hurricane Andrew passed over Turkey Point. If you can Google the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's report on it, and a number of things happened. First of all, outside power was knocked out from the Turkey Point plant.
Mm-hmm.
That means there was no outside electricity to run the pumps, which provide the fresh water, which cools both the reactor and the spent fuel pools that keep the spent fuel from basically burning up.
Mm-hmm.
It was off for 5 days. Fortunately, in the case of Turkey Point, the backup generators did work, and they were able to keep the pumps going and keep the water flowing. The plant was without communications, neither cell phone towers nor regular phone lines were connected, and the plant was basically cut off from outside communication. The access road that goes to the Turkey Point plant was closed, and I think basically we're looking at a little less than a week that this plant was basically incommunicado from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been very difficult had those backup generators not worked. There was no communication, there was no road access. So we dodged the bullet. It's not as if I would be pounding my chest and saying, look, we're great. We survived this without mishap. There were mishaps. There were problems. And I'm not going to say it was a near miss, but the problem is there was a risk. And because a very bad thing didn't happen, it doesn't mean that a future hurricane won't create some other future problem.
Right.
They say that there's a 1 in 100,000 chance of an earthquake. It's true. We're not located in an earthquake zone. We don't have the kind of seismic activity located in an island like Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
However, things do happen. Earthquakes can happen. There are faults that people find out about. But I think the primary risk is the hurricane. And, of course, there's been other incidents that happened. There was a case of a worker at the plant, just kind of disgruntled worker, drilled a hole in a very critical pipe. One of his coworkers knew he did it, didn't report it. Hundreds and hundreds of interviews by the FBI and other law enforcement agencies to track down what exactly happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that happened at the Turkey Point plant.
Now, speaking of the plant itself, what about its record? I note that gentleman Roger Witherspoon wrote an article back in June of 2010. And he reported in that article that Florida Power and Light was fined $70,000 for improperly maintaining hundreds of tons of highly radioactive spent fuel. Did they settle that that case?
Well, they settled it with a $70,000 fine. I mean, it's kind of, you know, you think about that number. If you or I got a fine for $70,000, we say, wow. When you think about a utility like Turkey, like Florida Power and Light, which makes close to $1 billion a year in profit from their 4.5 million customers, being fined $70,000 for improperly maintaining the spent fuel pools, and apparently they didn't do a correct fix. I did read Roger Witherspoon's article, but I think it was basically adding a kind of boron substance to the pools instead of the way they were supposed to add it, which would have absorbed the excess neutrons that are released by this highly radioactive material. That's what, basically, that's what's happening with U-235. It's splitting. When it splits, it releases neutrons in addition to two new elements, but it's those neutrons which set off the chain reaction. They split other other nuclei. And the boron is an absorber, or a neutron poisoner, I think that's what the industry refers to it as. And without the right amount of boron and the right material in there to absorb those neutrons, you do have this problem of fission occurring in the spent fuel rods.
Right.
So Roger wrote that article, and I quoted in the Action Alert, and they were fined $70,000. I mean, there's some they say we didn't do anything wrong, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says they did. And that's where it is.
So they, but it, I, then I note that there is a St. Lucie. I want to stick to the Biscayne Bay and the Everglades, but I see the St. Lucie plant also had problems. So, and they were downgraded, or are their operations? Can you speak to that briefly?
Well, I can't really speak. I was putting so much of my time researching the Turkey Point expansion. I mean, the two new nuclear generators being proposed at Turkey Point. I didn't get that much into the current research on St. Lucie. But St. Lucie, if you look at the a map of South Florida, what you'll see is that I'll talk a little bit about the Everglades right now. You've got the Everglades proper begins at Lake Okeechobee, which is a big shallow puddle kind of in the south-central part of the state. The Everglades really begins right around Orlando. Many people maybe in Hawaii have been to Orlando for the Disney theme parks and Universal Studios and things like that. Well, just south of Orlando is where the waters of the Everglades begin. It's called the Kissimmee Chain of Lakes, and historically they would have flowed down through this marshy wetland, through the Kissimmee River, which was really kind of a river wetland area, into Lake Okeechobee. Lake Okeechobee's banks would overflow, go down into the Everglades and across the Everglades into Florida Bay and Biscayne Bay. St. Lucie is located kind of in the center of that ecosystem over on the east coast. The population center is completely on the east coast of Florida. I mean, there's 6 million people in South Florida now, and the vast majority live along that southeast coast, and St. Lucie would be kind of at the northern edge of it. Turkey Point is at the southern edge. So between the two power plants, you've got pretty much the entire, almost the entire population of South Florida kind of within the fallout danger zone of both plants. St. Lucie, I know that they received permission from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to expand the capacity of the existing plants they have there. It's also it's another coastal right on the coast, right on the Atlantic. When you're driving along A1A is the road that drives along the east coast of Florida. Suddenly you'll go over a little bridge and the water is just coming right in and coming right out, circulating through the plant and out again. So there's concerns. And you know, in St. Lucie they're using seawater to go in and out of the plant. What they did in, when they first built the Turkey Point facility, and it does include fossil fuel plants as well. I should mention that. There are two oil and gas generators at Turkey Point. There's also a new gas-fired plant there. There are fuel tanks all over the place. But the plants are cooled by fresh water, supposedly But the fresh water was originally going directly from the plant into Biscayne Bay. And said, well, we can't release hot water into the bay. So they decided that the solution would take 5,000 acres of mangroves and create hundreds of miles of cooling canals in those mangroves.
Mm-hmm.
So now the water is circulated from the cooling canals into the plant and out again. The problem is that water is still hot, and the bay does intrude into those cooling canals. So you start out, the water does become salty, and as that hot water evaporates, it becomes more and more salty, and then you've got the problem of heavily, it's about 2 to 3 times the salinity of Biscayne Bay, heavy salt water pouring down into the Biscayne Aquifer. I mean, there's so many aspects to this, Carol, it's sort of hard to cover everything. But
so this, with this salinity changing, what species are being impacted? You have any, has anybody
I'm
done kinda, studies?
I kind of lost, I'm losing a little bit of that sentence, that question, Carol.
Salinity, has it had any problems or bad effects on the species that are found there, the aquatic species or bird population?
Well, it's impacting the entire ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
because I was sort of trying to describe the Everglades as this big, flat, watery plain that now has, well, the east coast of the Everglades was always the Atlantic coastal ridge, but it was broken through with sections of the glades they call it transverse glades that would kind of poke through. But when I call it a ridge, I'm talking a few feet above sea level. The salinity that's pouring into the aquifer from the cooling canals is spreading not only through the, and that aquifer, by the way, the Biscayne Aquifer, is the water supply for all of Miami-Dade County, all of Broward County, where I live, which is Fort Lauderdale, and the southern part of Palm Beach County. So the majority of people who live in South Florida, I guess you can call human beings and other species, are completely dependent on that natural fresh water. There is no source of fresh water outside of the Biscayne Aquifer. Impacts on taking a wetland, a freshwater wetland or an estuarine wetland,
mm-hmm.
and turning it and increasing the salinity are tremendous. Places like Biscayne Bay, Florida Bay, which is connected to Biscayne Bay, it's really just another section of it. It's just they call one section Biscayne Bay. Kind of the northern section is Biscayne, and you kind of come around the bottom of Florida and it becomes Florida Bay, but it's all one body of water, one of the greatest estuaries in the world. With countless species living in it. I mean, you've got three species of sea turtles. You've got the Florida manatee that lives here. Dozens and dozens of species of fish, plankton, shrimp, spiny lobster. I mean, it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
Wood storks, snail kites. We have, when you look at the list of endangered and threatened species in places like Biscayne National Park, Everglades National Park, it's dozens and dozens, in addition to species which are not yet listed. So species that existed, that evolved, or the ecosystem evolved as a freshwater estuary becoming highly saline, it's completely unnatural, and it doesn't support the life that, the ecosystem is already suffering from a lack of water. Biscayne Bay was at one time connected to the Everglades. The Everglades would basically flow out into Biscayne Bay. When you read some of the historical documents, you hear incredible stories that sailors used to sail into Biscayne Bay, and they knew of places in the bay where wells, upwelling of fresh water was so strong they could literally lower buckets from their ships into these kind of pockets of fresh water in the bay itself and draw up fresh water out of the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's long gone, you know, with 6 million people now living along the shore, roads and hundreds of miles, I think it's about 1,500 miles of canals that were used to drain the Everglades. So the system is already stressed out.
Right.
Now you add the cooling canals. The new plants, let me talk a little bit about how they're planning on cooling the new plants. It's pretty incredible.
Okay.
They're going to need 80 million gallons a day of water, and instead of using the cooling canals, which are already at capacity, they're going to build cooling towers, and the plan is to run 80 million gallons a day of sewage, recycled sewage, not pure sewage, but recycled sewage through these cooling canals. You could remove some things from sewage. You can't remove everything. You can't remove pharmaceuticals. So you're going to have this recycled sewage with pharmaceuticals running through a power plant, a nuclear power plant, to cool it.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty bizarre
so
to a lot of folks.
Now, a lot of this falls in private lands and also state and federal lands. What is the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, doing? Are they managing it, and do you believe that, is there any problems with the management?
Well, every project that gets built on a wetland, the Army Corps of Engineers does have to come in and provide a dredge and fill permit. And, of course, they have to also do what's called a biological assessment to determine if there's any possibility of listed species being impacted. If they determine that there are potential impacts, then they have to do what's called a Section 7 consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service, who are then asked to provide a biological opinion. And it's the biological opinion which determines the impacts. If there's critical habitat, they have to say if the if a given project is going to affect critical habitat for a given species. If there is no critical habitat, they still have to determine if the project will create jeopardy for that species.
So how is that working out? I mean, is it in place? Are they vigilant about it, these agencies?
I would say in general the Fish and Wildlife Service locally in Florida could do a much, much better job on their management of endangered species across the board, not only with regard to a new nuclear power plant, but you know, there's so many special species in the Everglades, and if you look at the eastern United States, there's a reason why the Everglades still has Florida panthers and manatees, and it's not just the weather. I mean, Florida panther, for example, is really the southeast panther. It was a subspecies of the panther that ranged from Texas to South Carolina and included all of Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Louisiana, Arkansas, and all of Florida. And today the Florida panther only lives in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that this is the last little bit. I mean, this is the frontier of the eastern United States. And Fish and Wildlife Service has been on the job the whole time approving development after development, whether it's a power plant, whether it's a golf course, a new university, a shopping center, a residential community. They rarely say no to anything. So I wouldn't be keeping my fingers crossed that the local office of the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to find a problem, even with something like two new nuclear power plants on the shores of a very critical bay and right next to Biscayne National Park and right next to Everglades National Park.
Would you, point in the direction of, is it politics? The scientists and the people hired generally have good ethics. Is it politics, local politics, or national politics, or Florida Power and Light having influence? What do you think is fueling this?
That's a great question, Carol. Of course, we hear about decisions. We seldom hear how decisions are made. We're just not privy to that information.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that Florida Power and Light is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, corporation in Florida. It's a massive economic engine. When they release lobbying statistics on various companies, FP&L, Florida Power and Light, is usually at the very top.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just local. I mean, it's not just our local government in Tallahassee that gets lobbied, but local politicians in cities and counties, on the county level, state senators, state house members, but also they have their lobbyists working in Washington, D.C., and they're very active. So exactly how a local administrator of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service becomes influenced is, I can talk a little bit about one aspect of this project, though, that I think you and the listeners there in Hawaii would find interesting.
Okay.
As part of the application for this new nuclear plant, they're also including new power lines. They need to have new power lines to take all this juice and run it up north from Biscayne Bay to Broward and Palm Beach and maybe even sell it on the entire Atlantic seaboard, because energy can be moved and sold in that way. Well, to build these new, so the proposal or the application to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission includes one massive power line right through the heart of the densest population of Miami-Dade, but also three new power lines across the eastern edge of what is currently Everglades National Park. And those power lines are massive. The proposed power lines are 150 feet tall, carrying 500,000 volts of electricity. The way it happened was Florida Power and Light owned an old utility corridor in an expansion area of Everglades National Park called the East Everglades Expansion Area. And when that area was established by Congress in 1989, the National Park Service was authorized to acquire all of the lands within that 100,000-acre-plus parcel. And that included the corridor from FPNL. I have documents that I've obtained from the National Park Service through a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, that show that the National Park Service at the time followed the law, followed the Act of Congress, and assessed the value of that corridor from FPNL and said, here's what you've got about 200-plus acres. We're valuing it at X number of dollars, and here's what we're prepared to give you for it. It would be great if you accept our offer. If not, we're prepared to enter into condemnation and acquire the property in that way. Well, FPNL didn't like that. And nothing ever happened. The land was never acquired, that corridor in the center of Everglades National Park in the expansion area. And they worked out a deal where they would move it over to the eastern edge of Everglades National Park, the first biological park in our country, in our nation's history. And the eastern edge, in other words, the corridor would be moved to the eastern edge of the park, and that would then become FPNL property. Well, that can't happen without a new act of Congress that would actually change the borders of a national park. And believe it or not, they got it. In 2009, there was an omnibus land bill that was passed. It created a lot of new wilderness, but it also included a provision to transfer land from the National Park Service to FPNL. And that provision was supported by the two senators of Florida at the time, Senator Bill Nelson, Senator Mel Martinez, and it was authorized by Congress. Now, that didn't mandate the transfer. It's still going to be up to the National Park Service to make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
But you were asking about influence and power. You know, when they say it takes an act of Congress to do it, apparently FPNL has that much power that they were able to get an act of Congress passed to acquire something they wanted.
And we're talking about remnants of the Everglades left. Not much left when you consider what was originally out there. And politics is taking it away, huh?
Well, politics and economics combined is, you know, I guess economics is really the engine, and politics is pretty much the way those things happen. I mean, you've got here in Florida, you've got, initially before we had 6 million people living down here, and I'm one of those 6 million that moved down here, I have to say that, although I try to, live in such a way, not just personally, but also in the policies that I advocate, is to say, well, even if you're going to urbanize, you don't have to create more and more destruction and degradation of the areas that are still intact, those remnants of the Everglades. But what seems to happen here is even on the local level, for example, I do a lot of work on behalf of the Florida Panther. There's 100 panthers left here in South Florida. And that's not a lot, but the panther is a big cat. It needs a lot of territory. It's not a pack animal. Males will fight each other. Males will even kill females when they feel they're being crowded in.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, it's the local county commissioners in the various counties where panthers do live that are constantly willing to take agricultural lands and say, yeah, we can change the zoning on that. Go ahead and put a development in there.
Wow.
So I think that anybody who comes to South Florida, or even if you just go online and Google it, or even look at it in Google Earth, you'll see this massive kind of encroachment of human beings. You know, the Turkey Point power plant is one aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
but this massive encroachment of human beings, roads, new roads constantly, canal building, developments. Go ahead, Rick. I'm sorry.
Sugar cane, is it still being farmed or raised there in the Everglades area?
I heard something about sugarcane.
Right.
I can talk about that a little bit. We talked about the Kissimmee River kind of and the northern flow of the Everglades flowing into Lake Okeechobee. So the Everglades proper began at the south shore of Lake Okeechobee, where the lake would basically fill up with water during the wet season, and we do have that kind of tropical weather dry and wet season. We're just transitioning now from the dry to the wet season.
Mm-hmm.
But traditionally what would happen is that lake would fill up. It's just kind of a big shallow puddle, and the southern shore would just overflow, and it was that overflow of water across the entire southern shore of Lake Okeechobee, which was the Everglades. Well, that created all that sawgrass. It just looks like a big field of grass. Living and dying and being submerged created a tremendous amount of peat soil.
Mm-hmm.
And people realized that if you can get the water off that soil, well, it would be great to farm it. And that's where all those canals were built. So the canals were built over roughly the last 100 years. Today, I think it's about 1,500 miles of canals that are in the Everglades. It got the water off the land, and it did create quite a agricultural mecca for a while. So the first 700,000 acres of the Everglades, from the south shore of Lake Okeechobee all the way down, is pretty much pure sugarcane.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a whole other program. I don't know, I'm not sure how much you want to get into it, but clearly lots of fertilizer going into that production, pesticides, and mostly it's the problem of nitrogen and phosphorus pouring into the Everglades ecosystem from the sugarcane at the north. Again, it's a heavily subsidized industry. There's no shortage of sugar in the world, but the sugar farmers that own that land are subsidized by the federal government with price guarantees. Not only that, but not only do they have a price guarantee, but they're guaranteed to sell every pound of sugar they produce, whether they have a commercial market for it or not, by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got this heavily protected industry that's just... it's not only impacting the quality of the water in the Everglades, but the quantity of water itself.
Mm-hmm.
That sugarcane takes a lot of water. And so as the first recipient of it, the rest of the Everglades, including our beautiful Everglades National Park, which is at the bottom of the Everglades ecosystem, is kind of left holding its hands out for handouts of water.
Which portion of the sugar farming impacts the wildlife in the water there? Is it the planting of it, or is it the harvesting? Has anyone looked at
the entire process? I mean, first of all, 700,000 acres is a lot of land.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got 700,000 acres of Everglades which no longer exists. It's now sugarcane. The impact on the water is tremendous. I mean, the Everglades was a historically low-nutrient ecosystem. And so the sawgrass does not survive a high nutrient load. What happens is, as the water becomes more and more loaded with the phosphorus and the nitrogen from the sugarcane fields, cattails start to take over instead of sawgrass.
Mm-hmm.
So you lose the native vegetation, and that's one significant impact is loss of vegetation just from the changes in the quality of the water. When you're dealing with changes in the quantity of water, because the Everglades, even though it's still written as the river of grass, it doesn't flow anymore. It's all contained. It's a system of these dikes and canals that I talked about. So it's heavily managed with pump stations and levees and gates. It's the water supply for 6 million people. It's also the water supply for the 700,000 acres of agriculture. So it's a heavily artificial system until you get down to the park. But the park doesn't have either the quantity of the water or the quality of the water that it once had.
Mm-hmm.
We're also losing all the tree islands, these hammocks that exist out in the Everglades, which contained hardwoods, tropical hardwoods, and there were slightly raised areas. Normally, they would not catch fire because the Everglades itself acted as a kind of a wet, spongy buffer to fire. Now, during the dry season, the hammocks do catch fire. And during the wet season, because of the levees, because we've stopped the flow of water across the Everglades, they get flooded. So they get flooded during the wet season, they get burnt during the dry season, and the hammocks are pretty much gone.
Mm.
And it was those tropical hardwood hammocks in the Everglades that really supported the life, that allowed the deer to live there, that allowed the panthers, the raccoons, armadillos, etc., to have some dry ground to basically... use as habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Those are gone. So we've got a severely degraded ecosystem. Agriculture is a part of it. Residential development is a part of it. And all the things we do to try to supply the needs of all those folks that have come down here is a big problem.
How many, Florida, the key deer, how many deer, what is the population there now? And if you could speak to some of the other animals that are found there for the listeners.
Yeah, the key deer, I talked about the panther, about 100 left. The key deer, you know, I don't know the numbers on that, on the key deer. I mean, I can tell you that there's not a whole lot left. They're essentially a species of white-tailed deer that are isolated on these little tiny islands in the Keys. Again, the Keys were these essentially raised-up coral reefs that run in a line along the southern border of Florida Bay. Mm-hmm. On one side of the Florida Keys is Florida Bay. On the south side of the Florida Keys is essentially the Atlantic and eventually the Caribbean. And it's the south side that has the coral reefs on it. The key deer is a resident now of just a few of the keys that are left. If you drive onto those keys, you can pretty much see them all the time because there's just not that many places for them to disappear to. They're often the victim of roadkill. And, you know, I guess there is a population that's surviving. How long they will survive, I'm not really sure. They don't have exactly the habitat range. They're not a wide-ranging animal. So I suppose if you keep a certain amount of habitat left in a few of the keys, they can persist for some time. But the range of the animal is significantly reduced from what it used to be. And it's quite something to see a deer, a full-sized deer the size of the key deer. I never don't stop off at a few of the places where I knew I can see them when I'm driving down to Key West.
I see. What about the kite or the snail kite? Are we seeing any decline or the bird of prey?
Snail kite is amazingly adapted to live on the apple snail. If you look at the snail kite in the few places where you can see them, it's got a beak that looks just like a can opener. Mm-hmm. And that can opener beak is designed to specifically fit into the shell of the snail kite, of the apple snail, and pull that meat out. It's got talons. I was very fortunate. I went out recently with some friends who knew one of the Miccosukee Native Americans who live here in South Florida. There are two main tribes that live here in South Florida, the Seminole and the Miccosukee. I just say that for a second, just diverge for a little bit. You know, when the Spaniards arrived here as part of their conquest of the Americas in general, Florida is one of the places they came. And Ponce de Leon, folks might have heard of, was looking for, supposedly the story is, he was looking for the Fountain of Youth. But he ended up getting an arrow from the Calusa Indians, who were the original Native Americans who lived in South Florida on the southwest coast. It was the Calusa Indians in the southwest and the Tequesta in the southeast, and which is now Miami and Fort Lauderdale. And to my knowledge, there are no folks right now who can actually trace their ancestry to these folks. So the Calusa, the remaining Calusa and Tequesta Indians left Florida. The ones that were left Florida when Spanish rule ended and Spain ceded Florida to the British. The Seminoles and Miccosukee moved in from the south. From my research, I've seen that they're mainly descended from Creek Indians from Alabama and places like that. But the Miccosukees and Seminoles do still live in parts of the Everglades. We're talking about, I am going to get back to the snail kite because...
I got a call for you. Hold on 1 second here, if you would. And we're going to be taking a break. I'm alert you that we got about another 4 minutes. So if you want to take this call now or you want to hold on.
You have a call coming in.
Hold on, let's see. Good morning, call, a comment, a question for the guest?
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I want to thank your talker there from Florida. He's really bringing a wealth of information to the island, and it does correlate with us, and I appreciate it. I don't know if I'm pretty sure your audience does too. But the last sentence that he just said about the Indians there that are living in the Everglades, they don't have any casinos, that tribe. Are they into the casinos? You could ask him that question. And about this bird that eats the apple snail, because we had a problem, but it seems like it's abated quite a bit over here on the island, because we have the apple snail here. And what else does the bird eat besides only the apple snail? And then if you don't have the food anymore? Will he die or what?
Okay.
But I'll listen off the air because it's coming to a break, but I may call back. But I really appreciate, Kyle, this guy on the air. Okay,
okay,
thank you. Bye.
Did you hear that, Matt?
Yeah, I did hear the question fine. Okay. I was able to hear the caller much easier than I'm able to hear your voice, Carol. But I can say that both the Miccosukees and the Seminoles have gotten into the casino business. They're doing quite well with it, especially the Seminoles created in a part of their reservation that was close to the urban area, the Seminole Hard Rock Cafe, which is one of the bigger attractions here in South Florida for tourism. They have national acts there, and of course they do have the casinos, and they're doing well with it. Mm-hmm. And as far as the Apple Snail, unfortunately, the only food source that it eats is the Apple Snail. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about the snail kite. Right. It eats the Apple Snail. And habitat for snail kites is shrinking. It's definitely a species that's on the brink of extinction, mm-hmm. and mostly due to loss of habitat.
Well,
and to loss of its food supply.
Hold that thought, and I want you to join me on the second hour coming up, and if you would, please. And
do you want me to call back in?
Please,
Carol?
Please do, and
okay.
I'll be waiting for
we'll
you.
We'll do. Okay.
Alrighty.
Talk to you
Thank
soon.
You. Hello.
Okay. Bye bye.
Alrighty, we're going to take a break here shortly, and hope you can join us on the second hour, and apologize for the slight technical problem. But anyway, I just want to share with listeners out there that no matter what we speak about, the environment or whatever, there's politics and there's big money, and this is a small globe that we live on, a small planet. Our actions can have an impact worldly, globally. So anyway, we'll be joining you here shortly and coming back.
When this whole world starts getting me down and people are just too much for me to face, I climb way up to the top of the stairs and all my cares just drift right into space. On the roof is peaceful as can be, and there the world below can bother me. Let me tell you now, when I come home feeling tired and weak, I go up where the air is fresh and sweet.
On the roof,
I get away from the hustling crowd and all that rat race noise down in the street.
On the roof,
on the roof, the only place I know.
Stay tuned for the second half of The Carol Cox Show right after the news on KWAI Honolulu,
K108.ARI.org, the Air Conditioning and Refrigeration Institute, certified.
This is KWAI Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
With IRN USA Radio News, I'm Precious Watson. The United Nations says it's evacuating its international staff from Tripoli because of unrest in the Libyan capital. The evacuation comes hours after Libyan leader Gaddafi reportedly escaped a NATO missile strike that a government spokesman says killed one of his sons and three young grandchildren. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is accusing the Taliban of using a 12-year-old as a suicide bomber. Karzai says the boy was sent to carry out an attack today that killed a local council member and three other civilians in eastern Afghanistan. Karzai denounced the use of children and youths in terrorist attacks as inhumane and un-Islamic. The Ohio River is already at a record level in southern Illinois and may not crest in the town of Cairo until Tuesday. That's prompted the mayor to issue a mandatory evacuation order. Police are going door to door throughout the city of 2,800 to clear out any remaining residents. You're listening to IRN USA Radio News.
Wow, do we have an incredible offer for you today on Amberin. You're not going to want to miss out on this opportunity. Everybody goes through menopause differently, and women are reporting that Amberin works amazingly fast. Best news of all, it works on everything. The hot flashes, to feeling more emotionally balanced, to losing weight. I'm even talking stubborn belly fat. Amberin is the hormone-balancing breakthrough that relieves menopause symptoms 100%. Naturally, now in the 5 years since Amberin hit the market, it's got a 92.6% success rate. No matter what your menopause symptoms are, this is the way to get rid of them. None of those scary artificial hormones going into your body. Amberin makes hot flashes and night sweats disappear. All right, here's the deal. Be one of the first 50 callers right now, and they'll send you a complimentary risk-free trial with a 30-day supply free. Call 1-800-893-3027. That's 1-800-893-3027. 1-800-893-3027.
There are still more questions than answers following Friday night's police shootout in the Holland Tunnel, which links New York and New Jersey. Correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Officials say it all started when police tried to stop two men in a Jeep near the toll plaza on the Jersey City side of the tunnel. But officials say the driver sped away and tried to hit one of the cops. That's when officers opened fire, hitting one of the men in the arm. Two of the officers also suffered minor injuries. The tunnel shooting caused a massive traffic jam. Julie Walker, New York.
A witness in the Syrian city of Dara says army tanks have been shelling the city's old quarter, which has been at the heart of the country's six-week-old uprising. He says military reinforcements have rolled in to join the nearly week-long government siege. Dara has been without water, fuel, or electricity since Monday, when troops moved in to try to crush protests seeking to end the president's authoritarian rule. For the latest news and analysis, log on to IRNUSANews.com.
News reports say that the price of gas in the U.S. may go up to $4 or more a gallon. That's pretty scary news for the family budget. But when you consider that many parents in third world countries don't even know what they're going to feed their children tomorrow, it takes on a different perspective. Now there's a way to help solve both problems. Get on your computer and go to usagoodness.com to get information on how you can start a home business to earn extra money in your spare time while providing food for starving children. Go to usagoodness.com or call 800-301-6177.
The various world crises mount up, and with them the increasing tragedies and strains on the budget. National correspondent Connie Lawn has more.
At this time, the priority centers on the tragic losses in the states affected by tornadoes, floods, and fires. President Obama has pledged federal help, but the budgets are not unlimited. It is hoped states, businesses, and individuals will contribute what they can in money and volunteer assistance. Billions of dollars are still being spent on the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. There is some money going to anti-government movements in the Middle East and Africa, and the U.S. spends billions in foreign aid as well as in domestic programs. Experts understand there is a looming financial crisis ahead. Connie Lawn, IRN USA Radio News, The White House.
The agreement aimed at ending Yemen's political crisis may be collapsing. The deal would have seen Yemen's leader of 32 years step down within 30 days, but an official with the Gulf Cooperation Council says the signing ceremony has been indefinitely postponed because the president refuses to personally sign it. A chemistry teacher from Maryland is the 2011 National Teacher of the Year. The Washington-based Council of Chief State School Officers says it has selected Michelle Shearer of Frederick for the honor. The 14-year classroom veteran is being recognized for her passion, her embrace of technology, and her focus on teacher-student interaction. With IRN USA Radio News, I'm Precious Watson.
Wow, do we have an incredible offer for you today on Amberin. You're not going to want to miss out on this opportunity. Everybody goes through menopause differently, and women are reporting that Amberin works amazingly fast. Best news of all, it works on everything. The hot flashes, to feeling more emotionally balanced, to losing weight. I'm even talking stubborn belly fat. Amberin is the hormone-balancing breakthrough that relieves menopause symptoms 100%. Naturally, now in the...
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away, yeah. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe yesterday.
suddenly. I'm not a handsome man I used to be. No, no, no. There's a shadow hanging over me. For yesterday came suddenly. Why did she have to go? I don't know. She wouldn't say. But wait a minute. I said something wrong. Not long for yesterday. Love was such an easy game to play as it was. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I did leave yesterday. Why did she have to go? I don't know. She wouldn't say. But listen, I must have said something wrong, not long for yesterday. Yesterday, love was such an easy game to play. Now I need a place to hide away. Oh, I believe yesterday.
Okay, welcome back to the Carol Cox Show and second half. Hope all of you are out there and enjoying what we're talking about. My guest today is Mr. Matthew Schwartz in Biscayne Bay, Florida. We'll just say in Florida. And we're discussing the Florida Everglades and the Florida Power and Light Company and the Turkey Point nuclear power plant and its impacts and proposal to expand it and what have you. So if you have any questions, Matt is a wealth of knowledge. So feel free to call in, and 524-1080 is the number. Again, good morning, Matt. Again, we're back on air.
Good afternoon here in South Florida. It is now 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. You guys, Florida's always wanted to be ahead of Hawaii, I guess.
We're trying to be ahead of you guys, but
but anyway,
as I said before, we still have a lot in common as well.
Yeah, we do, don't we?
We do.
Whatever is happening there is happening here in the same cause and effects and what have you. But we left earlier talking about the snail kite. And another caller, as well as the earlier one, called. And the snail kite is sometimes animals evolve to be so specific that they have a certain diet, and they are so specific in their behavior that it becomes a detriment. It adds to their detriment in that if you take away the food. So the snail kite has a very sharp, curved beak that it has evolved in to pick out. If for the listeners, it can use like a can opener, reach down and pull out the snails or a mollusk that it consumes. And I guess I'm careful to say, fortunately, though its natural diet was impacted, the introduction of the snail, the apple snail for what was it called, the escargot industry and what have you, introduced in that area, and so it was able to hold on by eating some of the snails. But let's talk about, if you could, Matthew, some of the issues with the alien species introduction into the Florida Everglades and the impacts.
Well, that's obviously, when people move into an area, they often move in with other species, or they bring species in, sometimes unintentionally, sometimes intentionally. I can talk about a few species of plants that made it into South Florida, which are very noticeable by anybody who goes out into the Everglades, and you see them everywhere now. Brazilian pepper looks kind of like a holly,
mm-hmm.
bright green leaves and bright red berries. I suppose it's a pretty plant, especially when the berries are on it. I've seen people cutting off branches and making them into Christmas ornaments, but it's a highly invasive species. It is, you could see it anywhere where there's even along off-road vehicle trails, out in the swamps and out in the big cypress, you'll find Brazilian pepper pretty much going everywhere. It just takes over. It's one of those plants that just, it's very hardy, it takes over.
Mm-hmm.
Malaleuca is a strange-looking plant, that tree that was brought in, because it's very good at, it could grow in a lot of conditions, but it's very good at sucking up water. They figured, well, you know, while they're waiting for canals to get the water off the land, let's just plant some Malaleuca to suck up that water. The problem with Malaleuca is it grows very densely, extremely densely, to where even small animals like marsh hares and raccoons can't really use that habitat anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It crowds out the native sawgrass we were talking about, which is the traditional Everglades, and creates a monoculture, and you see that in many, many of the wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
You've got another tree called the Australian pine, which takes over. You see that often along beaches, takes over the sand dunes. And the leaves that drop off the Australian pine pretty much sterilize the soil. Don't let anything else grow in that area, so you'll have a monoculture of Australian pine and pine leaves. The Australian pine offers nothing to the native animals in the way of a food supply. So, you know, here's three examples. And then you've got climbing fern taking over a lot of the old oaks in South Florida, and oaks are a part of the Everglades as well. So you've got hydrilla in the waterways. There's lots and lots of plants that have found their way in here, either inadvertently or through intentionally being brought in for ornamentation or for some other purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Animal species, the one that I guess got the most attention was the Burmese python. Burmese python is a well-known exotic pet that people have, and people sometimes buy a Burmese python thinking what it was, you know, a cool thing to have in the house, but after the thing starts to grow and gets to be 6, 8, 10, 12, I don't know how big, you know, these things can get huge.
Mm-hmm.
They're a very large snake. People will often, they don't want to kill the thing, it's their pet, but they'll let it go. They'll let it go in the Everglades. Well, the Burmese python is now well established in the Everglades. There's a breeding population. It is competing with the native top predators. It is a predator. It's competing with the gator, with the panther. It can eat basically anything it can get its mouth around. And there's a famous picture that was published of a Burmese python that had swallowed a gator.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, after having done that, the Burmese python that swallowed the gator was bitten by another gator. And you can see this gigantic tail of an alligator sticking out of the stomach of a Burmese python in the Everglades.
Wow.
And you can Google that, and you'll find it on the Internet pretty easily.
Okay. Well, I have a caller here for you. Caller, comment,
okay.
Question?
Yes, I had a comment. I wanted to go back to the original evasive predator you folks were talking about and the concerns with these corporations that disguise themselves as public utilities and then are afforded the golden ticket about our land and resources. And then the, you know, other comment I had was, you know, it seems to turn into a return on investment to their investors. And then there's no accountability for these corporations when there's disasters. So if later on you guys can just maybe give some comments back to that. Thank you.
Did you hear the question?
Thank you very much, caller. Would you like me to talk? I can talk about that now a little bit, Carol. Is that okay?
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I appreciate her referring to Florida Power and Light as an invasive predator. I think there'd be some people here who would disagree, and quite a few people who would agree as well. But without using that adjective, clearly this is an aggressive company that is interested in expanding, that it is interested in making a return on its work and investments that it makes with the people's money. But it's also true that the nuclear industry as a whole is a heavily, heavily subsidized industry that is subsidized with federal tax dollars. Florida Power and Light, we talked a little bit about uranium. You can mine all the uranium you want, and you can purify that uranium so it's pure uranium. It'll be mostly 99% plus U-238. U-238 will never power anything. It will never do a thing. You've got to get that tiny little percentage that is uranium-235, which is the fissile material in U-230 in the uranium present at a much more concentrated level before uranium can be used as a supply for a power plant, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5%. A atom bomb, I think, is 30% or above. And like I said, all you do is put the stuff together, and you put enough of it together, and it blows up. It goes critical. It'll form a chain reaction. The chain reaction that takes place in a nuclear bomb is basically the same principle that takes place in a nuclear power plant, but it's at a lower level, and it's being carefully controlled. However, that uranium is not produced by Florida Power and Light. It's being produced by the federal government. It's a subsidized fuel product. Insurance. You can't build a nuclear power plant that has the capacity to basically wipe out an entire urban metropolitan area without insurance. No insurance company in the world would ever dare insure a nuclear power plant. They're not going to do it. Again, the federal government takes on the insurance costs for the nuclear power plants, and the utility simply pays a subsidized cost to the federal government for that insurance. There's nobody that can assume the risk for the destruction of South Florida, for the South Florida metropolitan area, let alone who you even compensate for the destruction of something like Everglades National Park. You notice when the BP oil disaster occurred in the Gulf, and that was very close to Florida, and Florida, the northern Florida, was deeply impacted, there was never any discussion of compensation for national wildlife refuges, for animal habitat. There is compensation discussed for fishermen and people who work in tourism, but how do you compensate an ecosystem for damage? So the question really is the subsidization of nuclear power in general. Not only that, we have an administration in Washington that is pushing loan guarantees for the nuclear industry. Our current administration, with bipartisan support, wants nuclear industry to thrive and expand. Mm-hmm. And they are definitely promoting loan guarantees, so providing loans to these industries to promote nuclear energy.
Now
I'm going to talk. Go ahead, Carol.
Now imagine, as you're explaining that, I'm sitting here thinking, what then happens if you're the director of the local national park that manages the Everglades, and if you are the manager for the Fish and Wildlife Service, you have the federal government saying to you, in one sense, we're funding this, we're supporting this, and we're underwriting this power plant and what have you in the development of it. But you now have to come back and write some measures in place put in place something that's going to protect the resources, and you can't be too strong because you have the same boss, the one that's encouraging the development of these plants. And then the same boss is telling you that you got to protect these resources. Is that a conflict?
It's definitely a conflict, and you put it extremely well. Folks who, again, there's only so much material we can cover in a radio show, but some people might want to look at an act of Congress called the Organic Act, and I think that Organic Act dates back to 1917. And the Organic Act is what established our national park system. This is one of the great national park systems in the world. It's the first one and probably the most expansive. That Organic Act says clearly that the purpose of the national parks is to protect the scenery and the wildlife and the habitat for the enjoyment of future generations and to allow folks to use it, but use it in such a way that those natural resources are protected and preserved.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a huge conflict between a federal government that's pushing for activities that will degrade the national park. I mean, I talked about the power lines and how the Department of Interior is in negotiations with Florida Power and Light to transfer over the eastern edge of Everglades National Park to a public utility for the use of three massive power lines across the eastern edge of that park. And how could the National Park Service even entertain that idea, mm-hmm. knowing full well they're about, in another month or so, they're going to be announcing public comments on a plan they have to do, and I'm sure you know what this is, called an Environmental Impact Statement, an EIS. So they're going to look at, they're going to spend $1 million, up to $1 million of the taxpayers' money to determine exactly what the impacts will be, environmental impacts are on Everglades National Park from these three new power lines. Do we really need that study? Do we really need a study that's going to show that putting power lines 150 feet tall, carrying 500,000 volts of electricity across the eastern edge of a wetland national park is going to be damaging to the wetland, to the birds that will be, you know, there will be collisions, there will be electrocutions, to the people's ability to enjoy that park? I mean, you live in an area of a densely crowded urban area of 6 million people. You go into Everglades National Park and you're transported to some extent back to another world. You're going to look to the east and you're going to see power lines.
Mm-hmm.
This is not compatible with the ecology. It's not compatible with the use of that national park. And you're exactly right. There's our federal government is completely speaking with two voices on that issue of protection of fragile natural lands and the need to have economic development. Mm-hmm. You know, when our president was elected, when he ran, he talked about the green jobs revolution he wanted to put in place. I mean, I'm sorry to be criticizing our president on that point.
Well,
really delivered on that.
Feel free. We criticize anybody.
South Florida has more solar potential than any state in the eastern United States. Any state in the eastern United States. We rival parts of the southwest of the United States. We would like those loan guarantees and incentives going to our solar industry, which doesn't even show up. There's virtually no solar being used in Florida. And we could use the federal government to be a partner and help us get solar on our existing rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of new technology. I mean, solar's been around for 50, you know, I think it was during the Eisenhower administration, there was a report released in 1952 by the Paley Commission that said, we need to start developing solar, 1952. And Eisenhower said yes, and he put $100,000 a year into solar development, $100,000 a year. Put a lot of money into the Atoms for Peace program, which developed our civilian nuclear power industry instead.
Well, Matthew, people are interested in helping and getting involved sometimes. How would they contact you or the organizations that exist there that is keeping a watchful eye on these issues? How first do we contact you and website?
If they wanted to contact me and have any response at all, I mean, I do have, as I said, I'm executive director of the South Florida Wildlands Association, which its entire reason for being is to protect wildlife and habitat in South Florida. And by the way, I would say that most of these lands, I mean, if you look at a map of all of South Florida, not just the urban area, you'll see that most of South Florida is still undeveloped lands, and most of that land is owned by the federal government in the form of three national parks, the Big Cypress National Preserve, the Everglades National Park, Biscayne National Park, Dry Tortugas National Park, in addition to about a dozen U.S. National Wildlife Refuges managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge amount of federal land here whose ownership is as much the people of Hawaii as it is the people of Florida and the people of North Dakota. These are federal lands, special places owned by all of us.
Mm-hmm.
South Florida Wildlands was established a year ago after working many years through the Sierra Club and other organizations down here. You can find us on the web. The web address is southfloridawild.org. That's southfloridawild.org. We have a fairly new basic website, but there are various pages on it. You can learn a little bit more about the ecosystem and the work we do. My email address is southfloridawild, that's one word, @yahoo.com, southfloridawild@yahoo.com,
mm-hmm.
and they could reach me through email that way.
Okay. And again, folks out there, this will be posted up on the website at carolcox.com, carolcox.com. But anyway, initially when they formed all the parks and the refuges and sanctuaries, it seemed like a lot. But because of the encroachment and as the growth of people and the populations and the farming and the agricultural practices and the introduction of alien species, these very areas that were set aside now are threatened because they provide habitat for the introduced species. And by the way, we have that same species out here, the Malaleuca and the paper bark tree, or the, as you call the Brazilian pepper, we have it here too, and it's problematic, and they call it the holly. So
okay.
Isn't that funny, the same things? And so this is speaks to horticulture and ornamentals, the importation of these species of plants that are used in garden settings, but they get out and get control. So I take it that your agriculture department down there, the state and what have you, allowed quite a bit of the import in the pet trade and what have you.
I can't really speak to that very well, Carol, about the importation of ornamental plants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the state is heavily involved in eradication programs of the Malaleuca, the Brazilian pepper, the climbing fern, the Australian pine, hydrilla, etc. It's not something they're encouraging at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of it was sort of past uses and past importation.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the problem is there. But I think you're talking also about just the general conflict of folks moving into sensitive areas. And I imagine, I haven't been back in the Big Island since that one trip I managed to go there in the 1980s, but I'm sure I saw a lot of beautiful, beautiful places in that time that I was there. The Waipao Valley of on the northern coast of the Big Island,
mm-hmm.
was absolutely one of the most beautiful places that I've ever seen, and I would imagine that that's also a desirable place for people to want to move to.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means when people move into places like that,
mm-hmm.
always problematic.
I have another caller for you. Caller, good morning. Comment, a question for the guest, Matthew?
Yeah, Matthew, I don't think you live by the ocean in Florida, do you?
Yes, I do. I live in Fort Lauderdale. It's about a 20-minute walk from my house to the Atlantic Ocean. So, quite close.
There you go. Yeah, Matthew, I was wondering, your organization was extremely successful in getting rid of a transportation system between our islands called the Super Ferry, and I just wondered, and I'm not trying to be a wise guy here. This is a serious question. Do you guys have any super ferries that go down to the Keys that your organization has been able to get rid of?
When you say my organization, which
Sierra
organization?
Sierra Club.
Oh, the Sierra Club. Okay, great. I'm a volunteer in the Sierra Club, and we are active here in South Florida as well.
Uh-huh.
But in terms of ferry service, there's ferry services everywhere. I mean, from not to the Keys so much, but to the Bahamas. If you look at a map, you'll see that Fort Lauderdale is actually not really, I said the Atlantic Ocean, it's not really the Atlantic Ocean, it's really called the Florida Strait, and it separates the southeast coast of Florida around the Fort Lauderdale area from the Bahamas. So there are massive ferry services that go between the Bahamas and South Florida. We're not involved with any efforts to stop that ferry service, but we are definitely involved in efforts to control the expansion of Port Everglades, which is actually the major port in Fort Lauderdale area. Port of Miami, of course, is Miami. These are massive, massive ports. Most of the freight that goes between the United States and Latin America will pass through these ports, the same way that the port in Long Beach controls is basically the main port for goods coming in from the Orient. Latin American trade very much happens, especially along the East Coast and of Latin America and the Caribbean, happens in Port Everglades and Port of Miami, and those ports do have proposals to expand massively and take out whatever habitat is left around it. They're trying to bring in the big ships that can, I guess folks know that they're expanding the Panama Canal and being able to take in much, much larger ships. They call those post-Panamax ships that will be much larger than the ones that we're currently seeing. And, of course, Port Everglades here in Fort Lauderdale wants to expand to the point where it can handle these big ships coming in. And that would involve the destruction of more mangroves and especially manatee habitat here in South Florida.
really a double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, projects like that would provide, you know, tons and tons of employment, but then the other side of the coin is the destruction to the natural resources and whatnot that you're talking about.
Except, you know, it's a good point, except the trend is that, you know, I hear what you're saying, creating jobs and creating an economy and benefits, but it's questionable whether South Florida can actually get much bigger than it is right now. That Biscayne Aquifer that I spoke about is the sole water supply for 6 million people. Mm. Nobody would have ever thought that the Everglades could dry out, and yet it does dry out in some years. When the rains don't come soon enough, when we have an unusually dry season, it runs under restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that there is a limit to how much water is in here and how many more people can actually live in South Florida. Plus, this is one of the foreclosure capitals of the United States. If you want to buy a home and you don't have a lot of money, South Florida is a great place to come to find a bargain, because there's plenty of homes that are on the foreclosure market right now. It doesn't look like we're expanding anytime soon. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you. But
Carl, go ahead.
A lot of similarities between there and Hawaii in certain ways, but Matt, I have wonderful old black and white pictures from the 30s that my dad took when he went down there and visited. You know, just, I mean, the Seminole Indian standing in his dugout canoe in the glades, and all of the pictures that he took of the glades as they were back then, which was, you know, practically I don't think it was even hardly developed back then.
In the 1930s, hardly anything.
Yeah, and when you came on with Carol, I instantly thought of that and started looking through some old picture albums.
Well, send some and share. Maybe don't be selfish, Rob.
Yeah, Carol, thank you. Matt, thanks for addressing.
Okay.
Talk to you guys later.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it.
Aloha.
Another call for you. Caller, go ahead with your comment or question.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for this subject. I think all of us are concerned about the whole United States. I just want to say my mother, years ago, probably 60 years ago, had bought some land in Collier County, and because she just wanted to own a little piece of USA, and it was a swampland, apparently. And they said they were going to drain it and then build a jet airport. The Sierra Club was the one that saved it, I understand. And when she died, they wrote me and they said that they would buy it from me, which they did, but they said, if I didn't sell it, well, I'd be in court down there. And so I'm glad for people like you saving that, because I think she'd be much happier knowing that there were little alligators and birds and things like that. She didn't. Neither one of us has been to Florida. We have no idea what it's like, but she had heard about it and was excited about it.
Can I ask you a question? The land that she owned, this was your mother?
Yes.
Okay, was the land that she owned, was this land sold to the jetport developers, or was it sold to the federal government? Do you recall?
Well, in the end, it became part of the Big Cypress Swamp, they told me.
All right.
The Big Cypress National Preserve. Okay. Okay.
So she was.
Talk about that for a minute. That's a very interesting topic. What happened there?
What did happen there?
Okay. So going back to the Nixon administration, so Miami was already growing up as a major metropolis, and this was back in the days when we thought that that supersonic transport was taking over. So the plan was to build the largest airport in the world right in the heart of the Everglades, and it was the Miami-Dade Jetport. And they had plans for high-speed rail to run across the Everglades to connect Miami to this jetport. And then there was going to be transportation links in the other direction to the western side of Collier County, which is where Naples is. And the very first, I had mentioned that word EIS, Environmental Impact Statement. Well, the first Environmental Impact Statement ever written by the federal government was written in response to this proposed project of the Miami-Dade Jetport. And the conclusion was, if that jetport was built in that location, right north of Everglades National Park, right on the edge of the Big Cypress Swamp, which is also the western Everglades, it would destroy the ecosystem. Essentially, that was the conclusion. And the first runway had already been built. The first massive runway had already been built on that Jetport property when the Nixon administration was convinced to pull the plug on it. And it's pretty amazing that we did stop that Jetport. It wasn't just the Sierra Club. It was many environmental organizations, including Audubon. It was also the local sportsmen, the people who like to go out and hunt and fish out there, and the bird watchers, and just, you know, a tremendous coalition of folks who said that this is the wrong project in the wrong place in the wrong time. And fortunately, I can tell you that a few years later, the Big Cypress National Preserve was established in 1974, the first national preserve in our nation's history. It is managed by the National Park Service. It is an incredible place and considered to be one of the most biodiverse pieces of land in the entire United States, continental United States. Probably that's usually the disclaimer, because maybe there are places in Hawaii which even have more intense levels of biodiversity. But it is an amazing place, and I do lead hikes out there, swamp walks. We go walking out there, and it's a remarkable place to see the diversity of life that is there today. And thank you, Mom, for selling that land to create the Big Cypress National Preserve. It's appreciated.
Well, thank you for the report.
Alrighty.
I always wondered what happened. And thank
you. Wonderful place. Come visit when you come out here. Get in touch with me. We'll get you out there and walking on it again.
Great. Thank you.
Well, Carla, thank you for joining us, and we appreciate you calling in. But, Matt, small world, especially in today's world, we're speaking across from each end of the globe, so to speak, as we speak about this country. You got Florida, and we're sitting out here in the Pacific. Can't get any better, but just to illustrate how small the world is now. And here, what, you got two people that call in and speak. That's why it's important that everyone start to talk and speak out, because there are good people that work for the government, but they're caught in a whirlpool of influence. And most of them, I won't belittle them by saying they just go along and get along, but what are they to do? You know, they would like to do the right thing, but you have massive industry and massive movement and development and what have you. It presents a problem, and you guys we should take some plays from your playbook to see how successful we are here. You know, in this state, there's proposal to expand ocean open farming and all kinds of things, wind farms, which sounds good, but on one of the islands here, but to bring the energy to this island. It presents problems to the environment and to endangered species and what have you. So isn't it funny, the same problems exist here as they exist there?
It is the same problems, and I've been wanting, you know, unfortunately I can't really afford the trip, but I would love to come back to Hawaii. I was not involved directly in the kind of work I'm doing now when I visited Hawaii in the 1980s. I think it was 1985.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking like 24 years ago. My memories of the place are still very strong. But clearly, if I went back at this time, I would be looking at it through a lot of these issues we're talking about today. And I'm sure that these are two places that tropical or subtropical climates and tremendous biodiversity, but also a tourist-based economy, but also one that has to provide, you know, jobs for the people that live there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Native Hawaiians and Native Americans lived in these two places, Florida and Hawaii, for thousands of years without destroying the environment that was present, and they had a way of doing it sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, we don't have that. We just have not figured out a way to create an economy that allows us to enjoy the environment that we're part of in a way that keeps it around.
Mm-hmm.
If you, one of the things, you know, when I sent out the information for this rally yesterday that we were talking about in the beginning, I did a lot of research on the internet, and one of the sites that I found was, it almost looked like trading cards. It was the 100 biggest power plants in the world, and it showed photos of gigantic, you know, hydroelectric power plants like the Three Gorges in China, and nuclear plants and oil plants and gas plants. And you look at the size of these things until you've actually seen what a massive power plant, get up close and personal with these things. These things are massive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using more and more of the resources of the world, more and more of the world's landscape, and impacting that landscape in all kinds of ways. So this is truly a point in time of the history of our species where we have to take some, this is just my opinion, you know, take a deep breath and start looking at things other than economic growth, because mm-hmm. I can tell you, Florida is no longer, even in the 15, 16 years that I've been living here, I mean, I remember coming down here in the 70s, and we went on a boat from a marina in the Keys, and that water was crystal clear all the way to the bottom. You couldn't see, it was just crystal clear water. You can't see through the surface of the water anymore in the Keys mm-hmm. until you get way offshore. Lake Okeechobee, the water that I'm talking about that comes across the Everglades, the headwaters of the Everglades, it's filled because those when there's too much water on the surface of the sugarcane fields, it's back pumped into the lake. On the northern end of the lake, you've got tremendous cattle ranching and dairy farming. People don't know that about Florida. Florida is one of the leading cattle producing states in the eastern United States, if not the largest cattle producing state in the eastern United States. Mm-hmm. All that cattle waste has to go somewhere, and a lot of it ends up flushed into the lake as well.
Right.
So between agricultural runoff and animal runoff and human runoff that finds its way in there, the lake is, if you look at the mm-hmm. color of the lake, it looks like the color of stale coffee.
Right.
Was it worth it? Was it worth it to destroy, you know, one of the most pristine freshwater lakes in the United States for literally a few years of growth, development, and profit?
Right.
I don't think so. And you know, it doesn't help the economy that people know that about Florida, that they know that 6 million people are producing a certain amount of sewage, and I think it's about 300 million gallons of that sewage every day is being put into outflow pipes that go out into the Gulf Stream. The mm-hmm. idea is if you can get the sewage out into the Gulf Stream, it'll just go out into the Atlantic and dilute. That's not a solution for sewage and pollution.
Let me ask you a question.
They're only removing some basic what they call, well, just not to be disgusting, but the solids
right.
From the sewage. It's secondary treatment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not full treatment. So that water, you could see the outflow pipes. Divers go out there and take video footage of it. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
And it's 2 or 3 miles offshore. It pours off into the Gulf Stream. A lot of it sometimes, depending on the current, it drifts back in, covers the particles, will cover the local coral reefs. Carry all kinds of diseases, not
right.
to mention cut off the light that's hitting those coral reefs, and we're losing Florida. A lot of people don't know that. We have the third largest coral reef in the reef system in the world.
So it's
Great Barrier Reef in Australia is number one, the reef system in Belize is number two, and South Florida is number three.
Yeah,
and
so
we're losing those reefs like crazy through this introduction of sewage and, you know, not to mention rising global temperature of the water.
So what is happening, basically this serves as a nursery to the fisheries and other species. Let me ask you, I'm sure someone is going to ask me, well, why didn't you talk about the manatee? Can you give me a little, what is the status of the manatee, and is it going to be impacted further by, you know, some think, well, the warm water helps them in the wintertime, but
you're talking about the warm water discharges from power plants in Florida are definitely something that manatees make use of. I forgot
mm-hmm.
exactly where the temperature cutoff is, but
mm-hmm.
Manatees are definitely a warm water species. They can't handle water temperatures below. It may be as low as 68 degrees. That's the number that's coming into my head right now.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest problem, so you can say that warm water discharges from power plants can be of benefit to the manatee,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's what you were referring to.
No, I just want you to discuss, share with the listeners, because some people think it's beneficial, but what is it? Does the benefit outweigh the negative impact?
Well, the purpose of power plants, of these massive power plants, whether they're nuclear, gas, oil, whether they burn waste, I mean, we burn a lot of waste in South Florida, by the way, just another aside. The main renewable energy source that they consider it renewable is the burning of garbage. So a very large percentage of the garbage that's produced by these 6 million folks who live here is burnt as waste to energy, they call it. And, of course, there's residue from that as well. But talking about the manatee, the manatee's biggest problem is that I go kayaking a lot. I don't have a lot of time to load my kayak on a car, on my little Toyota, and drive it out to some pristine area. So I do what's called urban kayaking and just put the kayak in the canals of Fort Lauderdale and some of the rivers that are left, the New River especially, that runs through downtown Fort Lauderdale. And it's basically all developed shoreline everywhere you go. It's very hard to find any shoreline that is no longer somebody's dock, somebody's backyard. And, of course, the seagrass has been heavily impacted. That's pretty much manatees. The reason they're called sea cows is they just graze all day long.
Mm-hmm.
They're a very large animal. It could be a ton. They graze all day long. They need the seagrasses to graze on. And when we develop those coastal areas, we lose the seagrass. The other big problem that manatees have is that they're very slow-moving animals. They move very slowly, and they rest just below the surface. So they could be asleep just right below, a few inches below the surface, where they're not seen. And the largest cause of death for manatees, I know a very extensive study was done in Everglades National Park, and motorboats, in fact, is the largest cause of death for the manatee, except when we have cold spells, in which case the cold will actually do tremendous damage to the population. And sometimes red algae blooms that will create toxins in the water and in the vegetation, and that's usually as a result of fertilizers pouring into coastal areas that allow those red algae to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that, I mean, clearly the manatee is being impacted by development on many sides, and the warm water discharge from the power plants is a benefit, but, you know, development of the coasts, which is unnecessary. I mean, it's just unnecessary. I mean, we need those waterways. We need, you know, if Florida, one of the big industries down here, as I'm sure in Hawaii as well, is fishing and recreational fishing. Well, recreational fishing in Florida is terrible. It's just awful. A lot of the old-timers that used to fish out in Biscayne Bay and Florida Bay have just thrown their hands up and say, no more, I'm not doing it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the word has gotten out that the fishing in Florida is nowhere near what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And as people stop coming down here to go fishing, to enjoy the natural beauty and natural resources that we have here, that's not good for the economy either. So to think that you just can sacrifice everything for, you know, new golf courses, developments, power plants, etc., and think that you're going to create an environment that people are going to want to move to, That's questionable. The economics of that is highly questionable.
Right, right. Well, I tell you, it goes on and on and on. But I'm sitting here thinking there's so many things we can say, and one of them would be to suggest we readjust our views and our approaches to our use of fuels, and maybe we don't need all of the night lights to play tennis. Maybe we don't need... You know, look at species are dying. The environment is being impacted because of most of the time a luxury. Some of the things that how much energy is spent just in the crazy things, just lighting streets, for example. But all that translates into loss and habitat impact on species and what have you. So, is there anything in closing you'd like to share with us? I'd really like to have you back one day and let us know about this. The Turkey Point nuclear plant, there's a hearing coming up, and the NRC is accepting comments?
They're accepting comments, and I think I put that on my action alert. I think if you can put that online, I should have checked that email address that I gave you. I think it's hearingdocket@nrc.com.
Okay.
But I think if you go to the NRC website, but I believe it's hearingdocket@nrc.com, nrc.gov, hearingdocket@nrc.gov, people can actually write to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with comments about Turkey Point. It would be, you'd be referring to Turkey Point Units 6 and 7. And I can try to get you some more information that you can put on your website by email. But I guess the closing comments, I mean, I wouldn't expect people in Hawaii to be writing to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission asking them not to expand the Turkey Point nuclear plant, although they could, because it does affect two national parks that they own. But I would expect folks to be involved in these kinds of issues locally that are impacting the local fauna and flora, wildlife, habitat, plants, native species of Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I just was thinking as you were talking at the end, and I thought you were making, you made me think about air conditioning, and I thought about it that I never had air conditioning growing up in New York City. I grew up in a housing project. We didn't have air conditioning there, And we had, I remember what we would do. We would put a big fan in the living room window. It was kind of installed in the window, would blow the air out. And then we would close all the windows in the living room and kitchen and open up the bedroom windows at night. And you get this nice draft running through the apartment and running out through the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved into another apartment in New York City on my own, it was an old building. It wasn't wired for air conditioning yet. And even when they rewired the building and they put the wiring in, I never used it. And it wasn't until I moved to Florida where you're kind of forced to, because it's just part of anything you rent here or buy here, that air conditioning becomes a part of your life. And we can do with a lot less. We can do very well with a lot less, and we probably would enjoy the world we create at the end of it. People have not had all these luxuries that we're so used to now for most of human history. It's not a necessity, and it may be a necessity to go back to another time of living where we can have quality of life and a quality environment. So those are my general closing comments. And,
okay.
I appreciate it talking to the folks in Hawaii, and aloha.
Aloha, and hey, thank you again, and we'll keep in touch. And that email that you spoke about, to send comments to the NRC regarding the Turkey Point nuclear power plant
6 and 7, and they can also find me. You can go to southfloridawild.org.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find my email address and my phone number there, and anybody listening is free to contact me, and we can continue the discussion, and I'd love to hear more about what's going on in Hawaii and share
Alrighty.
With the folks in South Florida.
Well, thank you, Matthew. I appreciate you calling.
Thank you, Carol. Take care.
Aloha.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Aloha.
Well, it's sad, if you, from my perspective, when you see things, when we come and find places that give us so much and we encroach and we take and we take and we take. And that's what this is about. Maybe we can stop this downhill train. Maybe we don't need the greed. Maybe we, who knows? And I look back at the days of the, quote, the hippie, and we poke fun of him. And I hear the discussions now, the anti-environmentalists, you know. But you just can't build and build and build. The quality of life and the demand on the resources are going to be. We're going to paint ourselves in a corner as human beings. The cockroaches will still be here, and maybe that doesn't matter. But send a comment if you would like to support or against this power plant there. It'll be at carolcox.com. But hearing docket, that's HearingDocket at nrc.gov. So I want to thank you all for joining me, and as you can see, in Florida they're having the problems, and whereas the manatee is being impacted, whether it's the snail kite, whether it's other species, and as you hear, here we have lizards and myconia and what have you, it's the same. It's human behavior. It is, we need to review, and we need to hold government agencies who regulate. A lot of the plants were introduced here in Hawaii, for example, by accident. And in speaking to our behavior as citizens, when we, for example, do our cuttings at home, lawn cuttings, that's why they should be taken to the proper place, because if you take and dump plants or the cuttings from your yard from a particular tree or certain type of tree, there's a great chance that if you dump it along the roadways or in the canyons, within months or a year, a couple of years, you might see that plant that you dumped flourishing. And if you're driving around sometimes, look to see. And of course, now birds take seeds too, of course. I don't want to say that it's all about illegal dumping and what have you. But it's these little basic things that are happening within our behavior, that how we behave, that really presents problems. We have Jackson chameleons here. It was brought in by and introduced. You know, we have, there are a population of snakes on this island, believe it or not. But again, it was done, and as early as the 90s when I arrived here, you could walk in any store and buy scorpions. You could buy piranha. You could buy anything. It was just for the purchase. So we need to be careful, and I hope that bringing this issue about Florida to you is to share with you it's the human being and the behavior in our ways that's really creating a mess for us all. And we're polluting there, we're polluting here, and we're dumping our sewage in the water here. We have power plants that are dumping warm water, and all of this eventually turns into a really ugly situation, and we need to do something to change it. And I hope that this was helpful and giving you some insight and encouraging you. So I'll see you next week, and we'll be back talking about other things, and take care.
Ron's Detailing, make your car's appearance number one. Ron's Detailing is one of Hawaii's finest professional automotive detailing reconditioning shops around. Excellent services we provide, such as vacuum train high-speed buffing, water spot removal, paint sealant application, leather and vinyl reconditioning, full interior shampoo, and much more. Come down to 3006 Ualena Street off Lagoon Drive for a free estimate. Military and senior discounts are available. First-time customers receive 25% off the select packages. Pickup, drop-off, as well as shuttle services are available. For all your automotive detailing needs, call 499-5183. Ron's Detailing, we are the better solution.
Thanks for listening, and tune in again next time for the Carol Cox Show on K108.